Welcome to the FT Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:57 Pacific Standard Time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. There's really a lot to talk about, but let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And generally speaking, it's been reasonably positive for stock markets, not least in Europe, where we saw a number pushing on to new additional highs for not just the year, but over the last number of years. And the fact that you have the European banking sector breaking up out of what has been more than a year-long base on a relative basis versus the Europe Stock 600 is really quite positive. We're also starting to see some of the macro pieces fall into place in terms of what's happening in Europe, with Ireland's debt rating being lifted to investment grade by Moody's in here today. So that is, Europe continues to be an area where we see a re-rating and the perceptions of recovery improving, and the fact that the banks are more likely than not to pass with flying colors the various stress tests that the ECB are going to introduce, but also that they're returning to a position of outperformance is quite positive. Now, that doesn't countermand really the short-term overbought conditions that are evident in some of those European indices. So there is scope, at least in the short term, for some pullback and consolidation. But over the medium term, Europe continues to represent value, not least on a relative basis, particularly compared to Wall Street. The Nasdaq remains very much a leader on Wall Street, and it has one of the more consistent uptrends, and that uptrend is steep. So there is an increasingly large overextension relative to the 200-day moving average evident on the Nasdaq, but the chart generally remains consistent. So that means that there is no evidence yet that it has ended, but the risk of that eventual outcome is becoming increasingly large. What we've seen in the last week is a very good example of something that had become so remarkably overextended and then had one of these very large pullbacks. Now, that would be Nu Skin Enterprises. The share had been one of the best performers in 2013, rallying from about $40 to $140 and developing a large overextension relative to the 200-day moving average in the process. Not everything that develops that kind of overextension is going to pull back in such a sharp manner, and in fact, it unwound the entire overextension in the space of 2 days. We'll often see that a reversion to the mean will happen in a number of phases, and often in a ranging consolidation. That's obviously the more favorable outcome, because you don't get the kind of panicky reaction in a ranging consolidation that you do in one of these swinging pullbacks. But the example nonetheless helps to highlight that when something becomes really quite overextended relative to the 200-day moving average, that it isn't a question of if, but rather when, we're going to see some form of reversion. And when we then start to look at some of the social media companies that are trading on what can only be described as really quite fancy multiples, and those are multiples of earnings that in some cases have yet to appear, then what we're witnessing in terms of the momentum is a gambling mentality. And they are susceptible to mean reversion in just the same way as any other instrument. This week, and I reposted this chart in Comment of the Day today, it's the Bloomberg IPO Index. And to gain entry to that index, you have to have listed your company in the last 12 months. And the index is currently heavily weighted by Twitter and Hilton Hotels. But what's particularly interesting is that following a rebound with just about everything else in the market in 2009 and 2010, IPOs weren't particularly attractive from the perspective of an investor. They generally didn't tend to do very well until the middle of 2012, when they started to outperform the market. And that continues. What we've actually seen is that even though on a log scale you can look at the appreciation that we've seen recently and say that it's not nearly as large in terms of the percentage move that we saw for IPOs back in the late 1990s. In terms of the arithmetic move, we've had really quite a large, quick acceleration in terms of the appreciation of IPOs and new listings. Now, generally speaking, investors don't exhibit that kind of enthusiasm for new issues or new listings on the market when stock values are depressed. And what we've also seen is that we're not just seeing some small companies seeking IPOs, but really quite large companies. Hilton and Twitter are significant companies, and Facebook earlier on this year. So when we put all of that together, it generally says that when you have the number of IPOs increasing and enthusiasm for buying those IPOs, then we're generally in a pretty mature stage of the credit cycle. So, and that's not difficult to understand. We've referred to the stock market rally since 2009 as liquidity fueled, and the correlation between the stock market and the Fed's balance sheet has continued to increase. So we're at a stage where, in order to perform in line with the market, or even to outperform, one really has to be on the stock market bandwagon and to get long and to stay long, and that has a conditioning influence. But if one is following that strategy, then we have to remain even more aware that we are in a stage where the credit cycle is maturing. And the fact that the liquidity provision on which the market has relied over the last 5 years is also maturing. And the Fed tapered slightly at their last meeting. They're even more likely to taper at the next meeting, with home starts coming in at above estimates in here this week, and with the banking sector coming in with outsized profits, and profits well above what were anticipated. Bank of America this week coming in at 4 times its anticipated profit, and Morgan Stanley today. So the banking sectors are recovering in the US and turning the corner in Europe, and UK's retail figures have improved in here today as well. So we're starting to see that the worst is behind us in Europe, and the UK is starting to improve as well, and that the US is leading in terms of its growth outlook. So just how necessary is this extraordinary monetary accommodation in that environment? And the reduction of this monetary accommodation can be considered very positive, the fact that economies aren't going to need it anymore. And that's generally a vote of confidence in the ability of some of these economies to self-sustain in terms of growth. But in terms of the liquidity and the reliance on that liquidity that leveraged traders have, and algorithmic trading strategies, then the influence that that's going to have on stock markets suggests that we're going to have more volatility. And just in terms of logic, when you go from what had been a very choppy environment into a very consistent advance, and what we have had in the last 6 months to a year has been really quite a consistent advance, then that consistency will eventually give way to an inconsistent environment, and not least as overextensions relative to the 200-day moving average become increasingly large. So whereas we're presented at present with what has been a very impressive and consistent advance, then we know that the likelihood of the next pullback and consolidation, which is greater than anything that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 months, is getting increasingly close. That's very much in the context of Europe and the USA. And when we look further afield and look at some of the emerging markets, then it's really difficult to talk about those markets without talking about their respective currencies. And in the decade from 2000, what we saw was that the US dollar was particularly weak. And that gave the potential for capital appreciation and currency appreciation for foreign investors in emerging markets, and not least in Asia. Well, because the US dollar, because the US economy is that bit further along in terms of its recovery, that's lending some support to the US dollar. And of course, the corollary of that is that if the US dollar is getting stronger, then other currencies are getting weaker on a relative basis. And that's particularly the case in Asia, where we've seen a number of the ASEAN currencies in particular weakening quite substantially. And in some cases, not least the Philippines and the Indonesian rupiah breaking their respective uptrends and sort of embarking on what looks like a at least a medium-term top, and potentially opening the door for additional weakness for those currencies. And in the commodity sphere, the Australian dollar, having been among the strongest currencies in the world over the last decade, has got to a position now where it represents a liability for the RBA, and the RBA has stepped in to weaken the currency. So we saw that the Australian dollar moved to a new low yesterday and increased that deterioration in here today. It's down to 87. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the Australian dollar had been trading at well in excess of parity to the US dollar and much closer to 110. So we've had a substantial deterioration. It also means that from the perspective of an Australian investor, that keeping money at home over the last decade was really a very good strategy, because you had one of the strongest currencies in the world and you have the franking policy in terms of dividends. And it remains a high yield environment, especially in terms of some of the equities. But what we are now starting to see is that the currency is unlikely to be as strong in the next decade as it was in the last decade, and that the banking sector now represents about 44% of the ASX 200. So that's an uncomfortably high weighting, and there's no great evidence that we've seen the end in terms of the banking sector's performance, but 44% is really quite a large number, and it's an unhealthy reliance on the financial sector from the medium to longer term perspective. So the performance of the banks are likely to is really something that's going to be worth monitoring, and not least depending on how well the materials sector does. What we have seen is that over the last number of months, the industrial metal complex has been showing base formation characteristics. With the global economy beginning to improve, Europe and the US leading there, and Japan with the reflationary policies that have been embarked on by both the political establishment and the Bank of Japan, that Japan's economy is more likely than not to break its deflationary malaise. And when one looks at the potential for recovery, then Japan, having spent most of the time from May of last year going sideways, is really only now in the process of breaking out. So while there are some short-term overbought conditions evident there, then the recovery hypothesis is very much in line. And also that the devaluation of the yen remains very much on track, and is probably quite a bit easier than it would otherwise have been, because the US dollar is that bit firmer than it has been over, in quite some time. And as we move down, as we move along in terms of the major economies, then China represents potentially the wild card. It's among the top three biggest economies in the world, depending on how you classify the Eurozone. And it has this issue with the banking sector, where the the threat of non-performing loans has been put on the long finger for quite some time. And following the plenary session of Parliament in October, the new administration have been talking about giving the market more of a substantial role in policy matters. And we're now at a stage where one of ICBC's trusts, which has approximately $500 million in it, is on the brink of bankruptcy. And they're not inclined to save it. Now, if they allow it to go bust, it'll be the first time that a high-yield instrument such as that has been allowed to default. And investors aren't used to that. And the moral hazard in supporting those types of investment is probably familiar to the vast majority of investors, considering what's happened in Europe over the last number of years, and indeed in the US as well, with regard to their banks. So regardless of whether there is a guarantee or not, the fact that investors have relied on the market as if there were a guarantee is likely to have a profound effect on sentiment if a default is likely to occur. Now, the important caveat is that the Chinese banks have got extraordinarily high loan loss coverage ratios, well in excess of 50% for the major banks, and reserve requirements in excess of 20%. So they're moving into a problem with loans that considerably better prepared than either the European or the US banks ahead of their potential problems. And that suggests that there is the scope here for them to manage the situation probably a lot better. What we have seen now is that the banks that are listed in Hong Kong continue to hold progressions of higher reaction lows, whereas the mainland banks, exactly the same banks, have returned to test last year's lows and aren't that far away from the 2012 lows. That helps to illustrate the A share H share divergence that remains evident in the market, but also suggests that foreign investors are looking on the banks with these extraordinarily low PE ratios and high yields and these very large loan loss coverage ratios and thinking that not only would things have to be bad, but that the worst case scenario would have to unfold. And we've been through a number of crises in the last decade, but the worst case scenario isn't generally the most common scenario. And that would suggest that we haven't got any high degree of evidence yet that the mainland banks have bottomed. But they are cheap, and we're very much towards the lower side of their trading band. And that would suggest that there is room for a catalyst to evolve here. And if China can sort out the issues that it has with its overinvestment in a way that doesn't hamper growth, then the potential for global growth to really pick up will be impressive. And that suggests that really watching what happens in China is going to be very instructive indeed relative to what's going to happen in the rest of the world. And that Saxo Bank report that I've posted in here today is it has a lot of unlikely scenarios detailed in it. But what is interesting is that nobody in the report mentioned China as a tail risk at all. And that's really very different to what we saw last year and the year before and the year before that. So that at least twinges my contrarian instinct a little bit in here. And it suggests that really China will be very much worth watching. And moving on to India. India has a parliamentary election coming up before May. It's looking increasingly likely that Narendra Modi is going to win that. And since he has been able to deliver on reforms in his home state of Gujarat, then speculation that he's going to be able to deliver similar reforms for the wider economy is really quite bullish. And a lot of that is already in the price of the stock market. concurrently and an equally important aspect is that the RBA is doing what it can to arrest the decline of the rupee and is holding it here in the region of about 62 rupees, if my memory serves me correctly, provided the rupee can remain steady. And maintaining a reasonably steady rupee against the background of a strengthening US dollar is going to be a challenge for the RBI. So monitoring what happens with the currency and with the stock market is going to be instructive. What's most likely is that we're going to see some additional consolidation in the region of the high, not least as we approach the election. And if we get a positive return, a result from that election, then the chances of India being able to successfully break up out of what has been a five-year range will improve really quite substantially. Most of what I've talked about is skewed towards the medium term. But if we look at the long term, then we're presented with, in the medium term, this challenge of how to overcome extraordinary monetary accommodation and the reliance that markets have developed on the provision of liquidity. But when we look at the long term, the potential for productivity growth to come through from the technology sector, and not least in healthcare and materials and industrialization and robotics and automation more generally, and additive manufacturing such as 3D printing and scanning of 3D images and optics more generally, as well as embedded processing, then that represents just in technology alone, but then when one looks at healthcare and genetics and the nanotechnology more generally, and how not just on an individual basis, but more importantly, the fact that you're getting a confluence of factors coalescing around this accelerating rate of technological development. 3D printing is exciting on its own, and the developments in genetics are exciting on their own. But when you start to think about using 3D printers to print a customized genetic strands at some point in the future, then you're getting the confluence of factors that helps to accelerate innovation. And that's likely to remain very much a trend, because we're living in a golden age of technological development. And that means that not only are the companies that come up with new therapies and new products and new ways of doing things going to benefit on their own, but the consumers of those products, and not least in a corporate environment, are going to benefit enormously as well. So that's very much a theme at Fuller Money over the long term. And because of the productivity gains that are likely to come through from that, then that's going to be very positive for the wider economy. We're living in the greatest age of humanism that's ever likely to occur. And the global population is likely to rise from about the current 6.5 to 7 billion to over 9 billion in the next 25 years. Most of those people are going to be in Africa. And Africa is a region where there is evidence of improving governance, albeit from a very low base. And while the region, in terms of its capital markets, is still illiquid and small, it is growing. And how some of these illiquid markets respond to the withdrawal of extraordinary monetary accommodation is likely to be interesting. It's also likely to provide a buying opportunity from the perspective of a patient medium-term investor. So we've already had a great deal of urbanization in China, and India is a number of decades behind China in terms of its urbanization. But major population centers just about everywhere exhibit an improving general trend of and standards of governance, but also this pace of urbanization, so that there's a rise in the middle classes. And if you have a rise in the middle classes, it means that there's greater disposable income and greater demand for just about everything in terms of products, and that benefits the globally oriented companies that can provide people not only with the types of things that they need, but the kinds of things that they want. And those companies are also going to be some of the greatest beneficiaries of technological innovation. When we think about what's happening in the energy markets and the revolution that has taken place in terms of unconventional supply of both oil and gas, which has to a large extent been confined to North America so far, well, the potential for a global market to develop in natural gas is increasing rapidly with the building of LNG terminals and of LNG export facilities in a number of countries, not least in the USA, but also Australia, which is likely to exceed Qatar's exports of natural gas at some point this decade. And the potential for oil to trend lower, not only in nominal terms, but in real terms, over the next number of years is really quite substantial. And lower energy prices on aggregate will enhance, well, probably a better way to think about it is that it will turn from being a significant headwind to growth to being a less important headwind. And that's also generally positive in terms of productivity growth. So when you look at the three main themes, or the three branches of this tree, there are interlocking themes that are helping to promote each other. And over the long term, that suggests that what we've seen on Wall Street in the last year has been a breakout from what was a 13-year range. And that is base formation completion. And generally speaking, when we have the base formation completed and you get this substantial rally out of the base, then you get some form of pullback and consolidation to form a first step above the base. And that could potentially be a medium-term range. But once completed, we have categorical evidence that we're back into a new bull market. And that bull market, once a 13-year range has been completed, would have a number of years to run, and potentially even decades. And that's certainly what we've seen in terms of the 100-year history of Western stock markets, and certainly of the history that we have in our library. And you can look at the Dow Jones on a log-scale basis. You'll see a sequence of lengthy ranges completed by emphatic breakouts, which morph into these generational long bull markets. And the conditions there for a new bull market in equities are very much intact. If we're moving into a major bull market in equities, well, we're in the latter stages of a major bull market in bonds. And bonds, the total return on bonds, it comes from yield and capital appreciation. And the advent of quantitative easing substituted yield for capital appreciation. But the removal of quantitative easing will remove that reliance on capital appreciation in terms of the total return, and people will have to start demanding a higher yield for compensation. And that suggests that even in a benign environment, I suppose especially in a benign environment in terms of the economy, that a higher yield would be appropriate in terms of government bonds. But because we're coming off such remarkably low levels, then the percentage moves are likely to be quite high. It means that making money out of bonds is going to require quite a bit of finessing, and not least on the short end of the curve. Just how long the base formation in terms of bonds is likely to take, or in terms of bond yields is likely to take, is really anyone's guess. But what's almost certain at this stage is that the bond bull market has ended, that the low in yields is in, the high in prices is in, and that the surprises in terms of yield are going to be to the upside. And I'll finish with a comment on gold. Gold had put in a positive performance on 10 consecutive years, and 2013 was the first year that it had put in a negative performance. And prices fell from a high of around $1,900 and have steadied here in the region of $1,200, and they're currently up about $11 at the end of today and up to $1,254. In fact, gold posted an upside weekly Q reversal 3 weeks ago and has improved modestly on that performance in here over the last 2 weeks. And this looks like a reversion towards the mean, which is probably about another $100 above where gold is at present. Considering how much prices have pulled back and the fact that physical purchases of gold are beginning to overcome the paper sales of gold, particularly in ETFs, then the stage is set for some base formation development and potentially some lengthy ranging in here for gold. We're more into a ranging environment, and the consecutive annual return, the positive annual returns in gold are over. We're going to have a much more choppy environment in all likelihood, not least because in the previous decade, just about everything was positive for gold, and we can't say that that's the case anymore. The US dollar has changed from being a systemically weak currency to being one of the more attractive currencies on a relative basis, and realistically the only way you can value a currency is on a relative basis. And the institutional demand for gold has been trending lower for more than a year, and that had been a permanent tailwind. Regardless of what gold prices did, institutional buying and ETF holdings had continued to increase, and that's no longer the case. So we're back into an environment where supply and demand are very much more in balance, and that suggests we're going to have quite a bit of ranging. But it also suggests that the investments that are highly leveraged to the price of gold, such as the gold miners or the gold buyers, such as, and I guess the listing manifestation of those are the pawnbrokers, they've pulled back remarkably sharply. The gold miners were the worst performing sector on the S&P last year, and some of the pawnbroking shares have pulled back by 50% in the last year. If gold is beginning to form a base in here, and if the low for gold is somewhere between $1,200 and $1,000, then, and we don't have any categorical evidence yet that gold has actually bottomed, but there is, I think there is reason to be hopeful that the lows around the $1,150 to $80 area could potentially be the low for gold in this environment. Well, that would suggest that the sharp deterioration that we've seen in gold-related investments is also probably towards its latter stages, and that they could potentially represent value at these levels. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.